My name is Robert Ray, registration number 6197, attorney for the appellant William Hernandez. Your honors, counsel for the people. I've been practicing law in the state of Colorado since October of 1970, both as a prosecutor and a defense attorney. Apparently, given the outcome of this case, practice doesn't make perfect. In my practice of law, this is the greatest travesty of injustice that I've seen. The system has failed. The system has failed in many respects. We have a legislature who has enacted statutes that are draconian in nature, that treat every sex offense as though it were Ted Bundy, that makes no distinction for minor indiscretions over major indiscretions when it comes to a child. The judicial system has failed. When it says, first of all, we abandon our argument about child hearsay shouldn't be allowed in at all. I understand all the case laws against me. I still disagree with it. I think a person should only be convicted on what is said in court, not what is said in some avenue where the person is protected, nobody cross-examines, nobody questions anything, but they just give a statement and it's all taken as true and factually correct. Person shouldn't be convicted on that. But the law's against me on that. I understand that. But the law's not against me on whether or not it should be given to them two times, three times, which happened in this case. Second time in prosecutor's closing or opening statement where she showed parts of the video of the child hearsay. I had a standing objection to that coming in any time. The third time when the court allowed the jury to view the whole interview again. That is wrong. A person should be convicted on what is said in front of the jury, not what they were able to say outside of the presence of anybody questioning anything. I failed because I didn't argue vociferously enough to keep that out from the jury the third time or the second time. I should have. I said, I objected to it, but I understood the case law was against me, and I knew that the judge was going to allow it in, and I apparently just gave up. I failed. And finally, the Sex Offender Management Board has failed in that it has these rules that if you go into their program and you won't admit, you get kicked out of the program. It doesn't matter how compliant you are. It doesn't matter whether you're participating or not. It doesn't matter anything. It matters only that you must confess. Well, that's really hard on a man who's innocent. It's really hard for a man to, innocent people are convicted, and it's really hard for an innocent man to go in front of that treatment facility and say, yeah, I did this, and he's not going to pass the polygraph. If he says he did it when he didn't do it. Then they'll kick him out for not passing the polygraph. That board is wrong, but that only gets to the issue about sentencing, which we should not get to in this case. There is no evidence in this case, other than the statement of a 10-year-old, 11-year-old girl who made an allegation 2 months after it allegedly happened. Nobody noticed any difference in her demeanor. Nobody noticed anything. Her cousin asked her, is your stepdad sexually abusing you? Well, no, he's not, but William Hernandez did this to me. That's it. That's all there is in this case. Now, there are many inconsistencies in this case. We put out in our brief, there are inconsistencies about what he touched her with, his hand or his arms. Or did it happen in the kitchen? Did it happen in the living room? But you know, there are some facts that aren't in. This was in broad daylight. This was in the home of the alleged victim, and her parents and her siblings were all present.
Excuse me, Mr. Ray, isn't it the role of the jury to resolve such inconsistencies?
Absolutely. And you know what? They were obviously struggling with this because it was 6-6 until They show the video again. And that's when he got convicted. And that's what I'm saying. This man got convicted on the video, the child hearsay. He did not get convicted on what was testified to in court under oath. That's the problem with this case, is that showing of that video three times to this jury. Three times. It was 6-6 after they'd seen it twice. Parts of it twice. I don't want to mislead parts of it twice. It was 6-6. We showed the video again, they come back guilty. It doesn't take a genius to figure out it was a video that convicted him. As I indicated, this girl, she gave a lot of different statements as to what happened and how it happened. And people have asked the question, well, why would she lie? I don't know why would she lie. And you know what? It's not my burden to prove why she's lying. Whether she's transferred from what her stepdad did to her or William Hernandez did to her, I don't know. It's not my job. It's their job to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was telling the truth. And we always get back to the video. We always get back to the fact that the video was shown to her portions of it three times. Always get back to that. This man should not have been convicted. This man has maintained his innocence throughout the proceedings, at every stage. He got on the stand and professed his innocence. He can't do more. This man would not go in when the probation department interviewed him and the sex offender people interviewed him and said, yeah, I did it, so that he could get probation. He wouldn't do it because this man is innocent and he has been wrongfully convicted. Now, I understand the case law, and again, I disagree with the case law. I believe there should have been a unanimity instruction on whether or not this jury was unanimous in finding whether this, if you believe there was a touching, the seconds of touching on the clothing of the breasts of this 10-year-old saying, when did you get these? First of all, there's nothing in that to show that that's for abuse, arousal, or gratification. It's somebody screwing around. When did you get these? If you believe it happened. But now the people are arguing, well, they don't have to agree on whether or not it was abuse, arousal, or gratification. They just have to agree, they have to all believe it was one of those. That really doesn't make much sense. Although I understand the case law on that also, when you say a man can be convicted if part of the jury believes he had a knife and part of the jury believes he had a gun. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me, but apparently that's the case law right now. But I still believe there should have been a unanimity instruction. That's up to the judge to give that instruction. He didn't give that instruction, and that is a reason to remand this case. Assuming you don't agree with me on any of my arguments, this man does not belong in the penitentiary. He has no criminal record. On a scale of 1 to 10, if you believe he did this, this is a 1. If he were an adult, it would be a misdemeanor. He would have been sentenced at worst to the county jail. He is serving 2 years to life. And given the way the system is working, he may be in there for the rest of his life for allegedly touching the clothing over the breast of a 10-year-old and saying, when did you get these? That's not right. Nobody can believe that's right. He should have been given probation. The judge said, well, I'm not going to give you probation because you won't confess. When has that ever been a reason not to give somebody probation? He was accepted in community corrections. He was accepted by the probation department. And the judge said, I'm not going to give you probation because you're not going to confess, and therefore you're going to be right back in front of this court. Well, let's see how it works out. At the worst, this man should be on probation.
Mr. Ray, you obviously are aware that we can't supplant our discretion for the trial courts if the trial court's discretion is within acceptable limits.
You can find it's an abuse of discretion. You can find that. You can find it's an abuse of discretion to put a man who did, if he did what they allege he did, put this man in prison for up to the rest of his life. You can find that's an abuse of discretion and should be on probation. Yes, you can. You can remand it for the judge at least to reconsider that issue. You know, the proportionality. I mean, I don't know how anybody can look at the facts of this case and say, you know, this is a case where this man really belongs in jail for 2 years to the rest of his life. It doesn't make any sense to believe that, to think that under the facts of this case, this is a fair and proper sentence. And we would ask the court to do the proportionality review in this case. I don't think there's anything in the record or anything else that would say a man under these circumstances should be given 2 years to life. And so we are asking the court to do that in the final analysis. But again, we believe this man is innocent. We believe he deserves a new trial, a trial at which this court instructs that I understand you got allowed in once, but it's only going to be allowed in once. Let the man be tried on the testimony that's given in court, not the testimony that's given outside of the court. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Ray, you have about 3.5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Jacob Lofgren, registration number 40904. And I represent the appellee, the people of the state of Colorado. The people respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment and sentence for 7 reasons. First, as the defendant conceded in his reply brief, the child hearsay statements were properly admitted below. Second, in full compliance with DiBella, the district court properly permitted the jury to view the forensic interview videotape one time during jury deliberations, using an agreed upon procedure that all parties agreed to. Third, sufficient evidence was presented of sexual contact to sustain the defendant's conviction for sexual assault on a child. Fourth, the court was not required to give a special verdict form or an interrogatory related to the element of sexual contact. Fifth and sixth, the defendant's sentence was not unconstitutional, and this court has repeatedly held that the Sex Offender Lifetime Supervision Act is constitutional. And seventh, the defendant's conviction for sexual assault on a child was a per se grave and serious offense, and this court is not required to do an extended proportionality review, nor was the district court.
Mr. Lofgren, could you address the court's rejection of community-based punishment based on the defendant's refusal to acknowledge the offense?
Yes, Your Honor. As an initial matter, I would point out that there is no right to probation, and the district court here imposed the minimum possible prison sentence. 2 years to life. That was the minimum possible and the range that was appropriate for this defendant. While the district court did rely heavily on his consistent denial that he had committed this offense, there was no requirement that he confess. Simply, the record was showing that he was adamant in his denial at trial, when he went through his sex offense evaluation, and when he went through his PSIR. Under that scenario, giving the defendant probation would have been setting him up for failure, because he would have been put in treatment and instantly failed out of that treatment due to his denial. He would have ended up in the Department of Corrections in either event. This sentence was the minimum possible, and it was appropriate under the circumstances of this case.
Mr. Lofgren, let me just ask you, so if a defendant denies committing a crime and proceeds to trial, that's a defendant's right to do so. So is it appropriate to use a defendant's right against him in denying the probation?
I don't think the fact that he chooses to go to trial is necessarily the only thing the district court can rely on. I think once he has been tried and convicted, his continued denial and his refusal to accept any responsibility for his criminal actions can be a factor the district court considers, yes.
Well, Mr. Lofgren, following up on my colleague's question, it is a bit of a Joseph Heller catch-22 moment, isn't it? Because he loses the right to probation because he maintains his innocence. And that's what it is. It's not so much a denial. It's a maintaining that I'm innocent. And when he goes to prison, his chances of getting out in 2 years are vastly diminished unless he admits. Isn't that true?
I don't disagree, Your Honor, but I think the reason this case is different than other cases where this situation arises is normally what we see is a defendant asserting their Fifth Amendment right, remaining silent, refusing to comment during the sex offense evaluation or the PSIR process. In this case, the defendant didn't exercise his right to remain silent. Instead, he adamantly said, "I had no involvement in this crime at all," after a jury had convicted him. At that point, once a jury has entered a conviction, the defendant's continued denial should and can be used by the district court as a factor in determining the appropriate sentence. Very, very different than a case where the defendant was exercising his right to silence.
Well, let me follow up with a hypothetical then. So if a defendant appeals their conviction and they're successful, but if they admitted in order to get probation, can that admission be used against them in convicting them second time around?
Yeah, I don't know that that necessarily would be the situation presented in this case, and it, potentially it could be used against them. I think if we look at the facts of this case, though, the reason the defendant is in a tricky spot is because instead of choosing to exercise his right to silence, he specifically denied any involvement. The court used that denial, not the exercise of the right to silence. This court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly said that the right to silence cannot be used against a defendant in sentencing. There's never been a case, nor should there be a case, that suggests the defendant's continued denial after he's convicted cannot be used as a factor in determining an appropriate sentence, particularly in a case like this, where if the defendant continued to maintain his innocence during treatment while on probation, he would be kicked out of treatment, his probation would be revoked, and he would end up in the Department of Corrections. All that would happen if the defendant would have been given probation in this case is he would have been put in the community and been left untreated because he would not have been able to receive treatment. So for the period between the time he was placed in treatment, he was removed, and his probation was revoked, he'd be in the community completely untreated and only subject to the minimal supervision of probation. The court was trying to avoid that scenario by giving him a Department of Correction sentence, understanding that he would not be successful in a community-based sentence. Did I answer the court's questions with respect to that issue? I will briefly address the other issues that the defendant raises on appeal. It seems that he touched on all of the issues he brought up in his brief, so I will do so as well. With regard to the first issue, the child hearsay issue under section 1325.129, I would point out that the prosecution filed proper notice in this case under that section. The district court held a two-day hearing to determine whether the child hearsay statements should be admitted, and at the conclusion of the hearing determined that they should be using the factors that the Supreme Court has outlined in People versus District Court. The limited record we have available on this appeal, because the second day of transcripts were not made available, suggests that the language used by the victim in her statements was consistent with the language used by a child her age. Her statements were made in response to open-ended, non-leading questions. The statements were made in the presence of a trained forensic interviewer and her close family members. And her statements were consistent with her in-court account of the sexual abuse that she suffered. Moreover, nothing in the record suggests that she had any bias against the defendant or any motive to lie. There's nothing in the record that suggests anything occurred between the time she was abused and the time she made her statements that would account for her statements other than having actually been sexually abused, and nothing in the record suggests she had any character issues. The district court properly admitted her statements under 1325.129. As to the DiBella question, whether the jury should have been permitted to see the forensic interview during jury deliberations, the defendant contends that he objected, but I would ask the court to look at the record. The defendant made no such objection. In fact, he specifically said the case law suggests the jury is permitted to see this video. He agreed to the procedures the district court proposed, and in this case, the court clearly exercised its discretion over the videotape. It allowed the jury to view the video one time in a closed courtroom under court supervision. The jury did not have unfettered access to this videotape. In fact, their access was very much restricted to the one agreed upon procedure. As to the sufficiency of the evidence claim, the defendant in his argument today admitted that the testimony of the victim at trial was that she was sexually abused by Mr. Hernandez. Specifically, she said, he asked me to sit on his lap. When I sat on his lap, he grabbed my breasts and asked, "When did you get these?" That testimony alone was sufficient to establish sexual contact. The jury accepted the victim's testimony, and yes, accepted the victim's account in the forensic interview in determining that sexual contact occurred. There was sufficient evidence to sustain the defendant's conviction for sexual assault on a child. As to the special verdict form issue, there was no plain error in this case. The defendant never requested that instruction below, and the court was not sua sponte required to give it. The defendant, as he argued here today, suggests that the definition of sexual contact, which includes three possible purposes for contact, sexual arousal, sexual gratification, or sexual abuse, creates three different theories that the prosecution has to elect between. That's simply not the case. As the case law makes clear, all the prosecution has to do is prove the element. The element here is sexual contact. The motive for that sexual contact, the abuse, the gratification, the arousal, the jury can be split on which of those they think supports the element of sexual contact. They don't have to be unanimous as to that motive, simply that the sexual contact occurred. There was no need for a special verdict form or an interrogatory in this case. As to the SOLSA question, this court has repeatedly found the Sex Offender Lifetime Supervision Act to be constitutional. This defendant here was sentenced pursuant to that act, and his sentence was therefore constitutional. As to the claim that his sentence somehow violated the federal and state constitution, the defendant's entire argument relies on a Denver Post article and has no citation to legal authority. So I would ask this court to decline to consider that argument. And finally, as to the extended proportionality review question, the defendant here, if he had made a timely request, would have only been entitled to an abbreviated proportionality review of his sentence. Under that, the district court would look at the gravity of the offense compared to the severity of the punishment. If the offense was classified as grave and serious, only that abbreviated proportionality review would be required. Here, the defendant's argument as to this issue is that if he had been convicted of a different offense, sexual contact on an adult, he would have been convicted of a misdemeanor. Unfortunately, he was not convicted of that offense. He was convicted of sexual assault on a child, a felony and a per se grave and serious offense according to the Colorado Supreme Court's holding in People versus Stream. In that case, the Supreme Court described sexual assault on a child as a crime of the utmost gravity that involves situations in which an adult treats a vulnerable child as a tool for sexual gratification, often causing lifelong devastating effects. Those effects are evident in the child's testimony at trial and in the forensic interview. She was in tears the entire time she described this sexual assault. This is a per se grave and serious offense, and the defendant was not entitled to an extended proportionality review, and his claim fails an abbreviated proportionality review. He received the minimum sentence of 2 years to life. He's eligible for parole and could be paroled, and therefore his sentence survives an abbreviated proportionality review.
Mr. Lofgren, let me just follow up on that last point. So it's your position he is entitled to an abbreviated review, but that it fails?
If he had made a timely request. He made no request below for an abbreviated or an extended proportionality review. If this court is inclined to consider the issue despite the fact that he never made that request, yes, it fails. If the court has no further questions, the people would respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lofgren. Mr. Ray?
Thank you. Well, I would just stress to this court that yes, my client, when he went in for his interviews, was adamant that he didn't commit this crime. Yes, he was. And they want to use that against him to say you can't be on probation. That's the bottom line. I suggest to you that's wrong. And I suggest to you that if the Sex Offender Management Board, if that's their criteria, which I believe it is, that you must confess, it's wrong. If you can go through their program in all of their respects, you should be able to do it. The question is, can this man be out in society? The question isn't whether he's going to confess to a crime he's never believed he committed. That's wrong. They want to use his denial against him continuously. If this child hearsay is so important to get back to the jury a second and third time, then why don't we make transcripts of all the testimony of all the witnesses? Why, there were other hearsay, child hearsay statements that came in from family members. If it's so important that they be able to see and hear this again from the forensic interview, why in the world aren't we making transcripts of all the testimony and giving it to the jury? We don't do that. We specifically tell the jury there will be no transcripts of testimony in these cases. That's why it's wrong to give that one part to the jury. Not just the one time that I object to, but two times and three times. It's wrong. You are emphasizing one portion of the testimony. And it is so clear in this case what happened. It was 6-6. And they viewed the video and came back guilty.
Mr. Rake, can you respond to the representation of the record that this was an agreed upon procedure to send it back to the jury?
I had a standing objection to every, to any showing of that. That's clear in the record. I made it on the record at least two times. When this issue came up, do I agree now in hindsight that I didn't argue against it enough? It would not have done me any good. I know the judge, I know the case law. People cited head case law, and he was gonna let it in. I wanted to make sure that if he did let it in, the proper procedures were used. We were all wrong. We are all wrong. We have been wrong. We are wrong in allowing the jury to look at one specific part of the evidence, testimony I'm talking about. That's what this is testimony. We are wrong in allowing that.
Well, Mr. Ray, under DiBella, the Supreme Court has said that it's permitted as long as the court exercises discretion and adopts some appropriate procedures, which is what happened in this case. So are you asking us to...
With all due respect, the Supreme Court's wrong. The Supreme Court doesn't try cases. The Supreme Court's not in the battle. The Supreme Court is wrong when they... I don't think they understand how, in this kind of a case, in these sexual assaults, how devastating the interview can be in contrast to what's testified to in court. You are allowing that one piece of evidence to convict the man. They're not looking at the whole evidence. They see that video again and that's it. They don't go back and recall how she did on cross-examination. I don't get to argue against it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you remember now, you better remember. I don't get any more arguments. And that is, we have all been wrong on this. The case law is wrong. If the Supreme Court's saying that, they're wrong. In this kind of a case, you should not allow that to be in front of the jury more than shouldn't allow it at all, very frankly. It's hearsay, clearly hearsay. Obviously, it's designated as hearsay. But we shouldn't allow that to happen. And that's why this case should be remanded, and that's why you should remand it with instructions that that video will be only played one time. The DA won't be allowed to use it in her closing argument, show parts of it, and the jury won't see it again.
Thank you, Mr. Ray.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Lofgren. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.